I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And I have two wonderful guests today, Luke Devin and Emma Kramer of Osakana, a new fishmonger in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which opened in August. Luke is the general manager, and Emma is an assistant general manager there. And by the way, the owner of Osakana is Yuji Haraguchi, who came to Japan Eats on episode 2 talking about ramen, and also on episode 35 about his plan to open Osakana. Today we'll talk about the difference between Japanese and American fish cultures, how different Osakana is from other fishmongers in New York, tips to cook great sushi fish dishes at home, and much, much more. Hello, Luke. Hello, Emma. Welcome to Japan Eats. So, first of all, can you tell us what your responsibilities are at Osakana? So, Luke, you are primarily in the kitchen, and Emma, you are managing the storefront?
Yeah, absolutely. I manage the customer experience, the online experience, and we're booking a lot of parties now, so managing that as well.
Mm. Wow. So it's beyond just a fishmonger.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like. We'll talk about that. So tell us about your background. Let's start with Luke. And I heard you are from Pennsylvania and grew up in fishing with your father.
Yeah. I'm from southwestern Pennsylvania. And so a lot of the fishing I was doing there is freshwater fishing. Mm. But a lot of the time just either fishing in local lakes and streams and things with my father. A lot of catch and release, really, but still having the opportunity to eat a lot of the things that we're catching. Also.
Okay. And also, you used to teach at the middle school.
Right? Yeah.
So what did you teach?
I was a middle school teacher with Teach for America right out of college. So I taught middle school. I started as a science for sixth grade and also taught social studies and English and science through all the way through eighth grade.
Mm, so what to do with science and your career now?
I think actually teaching science at a middle school level was a really good preparation for working in a kitchen, because I think those concepts, if you can at least understand science through like a middle school level, the ideas about physical versus chemical change and just a basic idea of what is happening in that lets you understand what's happening in a frying pan or in an oven anytime you're cooking something. Mm. And just the different things that are happening, those processes are not so strange and are not beyond your ability to understand for anybody, really.
Mm. Okay. And I heard that you spent some time in Japan teaching English.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when and what happened?
After my time teaching in middle school in America, and I went to Japan. I lived in Osaka for a year and a half teaching English, which is a really great experience. I learned a lot. I ate a lot of Japanese food. I think before I went to Osaka, my idea of Japanese food was really limited, because southwestern Pennsylvania, at the early 2000s, there wasn't a lot of Japanese restaurants outside of sushi restaurants. Mm. I had eaten sushi before, but that was about it from my experience. So even things like Japanese curry or simple classic things like the miso soup at home, just like a vegetable miso soup, or those simple dishes that are the staples of Japanese everyday diet. I had never eaten those or had any exposure to them before I lived there.
Mm. So Osaka is a good place. It's famous for good, cheap street food as well as other good food, too.
Like ekimai, all the, you know, yakitori, ekimai, just a little stand with a, like a one man, you know, just doing skewers of chicken. Or even like when I first moved to Osaka, I was in a small kind of suburb, Shinkanooka, and there was a person there kind of between, on like a walking route between the one station and a big major supermarket that just had a basically like a station wagon that they were running a takoyaki maker in the back of. It was kind of amazing. And I'd never had takoyaki before. I had no idea what they were doing. You know, what is that?
Basically takoyaki is like a wound ball, like flour ball, and in center there's an octopus.
Steamed octopus, which is so good. I don't think I'd even ever eaten octopus before I moved to Japan, and that's one of my favorite things.
Wow. Okay. So sounds like what's a good beginning of your chef career?
I definitely learned a lot and got exposed to a lot of things beyond my what I thought were comfort zones that were still very comfortable and very enjoyable. I definitely started to fuel my exploration of broader things.
Right. So from that point, how did you end up working with Yuji Haraguchi?
So when I moved from Osaka to New York, and at one point there I just realized I was spending so much time at home cooking that I needed to do it professionally just to be able to spend more time and really learn the deeper things I wanted to learn. So I went to the French Culinary Institute then, ICC now, and I was there helping out with chef demos. We had guest instructors come in periodically, so I volunteered to help those instructors as a way to meet more people who were working in the industry. And Yuji-san came in to do a demo on fish butchery. So I assisted him there and met him there. And that was right when he was starting Yuji Ramen. So I went from having met him to try Yuji Ramen. And I had that uni miso mazemen for the first time. I think that really, really impressed me, because I'm not... I like uni, but I'm very picky about uni. And it was just such a great uni experience that it wasn't like uni overload. I think so many people are so in love with uni, or it's got such an iconic image right now that they almost use it like hot sauce. And it's like, so much uni on this. Or like, you know, let's just cover bone marrow with uni. And it's a little bit, it's just overdone. But this was a very nice representation of uni that was definitely uni, but didn't feel like using like uni like a hot sauce. It was it was considered, it was balanced with the white miso sweetness and the notes from a little bit of citrus and the shiso on top. You would eat it and there were just so many notes that flowed from one to another for such a simple seeming thing. It was very actually very complex as you were eating it, and I was just like, I want to learn his philosophy about cooking. How does he build these flavors? And so I offered to start working for him.
So, well, they who don't know anything about Yuji's background, he used to be a fishmonger, right? So he knows how to maximize a flavor, even uni sea urchin. Well, Sally, I have to say this. So you mentioned French Culinary Institute is international community center. Dorothy Aiken Hamilton, the founder of French Culinary Institute, passed away on Friday in a car accident. And we'll miss her so much. And yeah, she also was host of Chef's Story at the Heritage Radio Network. So yeah,
an amazing program. And
to her family. So anyway, so okay, so you helped to build Yuji Ramen brand by supporting him at the Yuji Ramen Smorgasburg and managing Kickstarter campaigns for Yuji Ramen and Osaka. So what was your motivation to support him?
I mean, I think we just had quality product, and that was motivation enough that I was making food I believed in. I liked eating the things that I was making, and whenever people asked about it, the enthusiasm about explaining what we were doing was just natural because it was so good. And the Kickstarter program just came about because we had a really great public reception, and we were we knew from the markets that we had people that were very interested in us as a brand and in forwarding what we're doing and increasing the scope of the things we could do.
Right.
So I had already done some looking into Kickstarters and had done Kickstarter for a previous project, a supper club. Mm-hmm. And I think especially for restaurants and food businesses, Kickstarter can be really valuable because you know you have that audience going in and, mm-hmm. and you get the response from the people who are going to come in. Especially any of these kind of food ventures can be very scary if you're trying to put an idea out there that you don't know if people want it or need it. You think there's a need. So it's amazing to be able to say, I think there's a need, and for how the public say, yes, there's a need, we want that, and be able to open these things together, not forcing something on a market, but really building from what the people want.
Right. So test the water, and also it's kind of like cultivating fans already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? You're very successful. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Right.
So now, Emma, so what's your background before you joined Osakana? And you're from New York, and I heard you had spent last 15 years in the restaurant industry.
I have. I've been working in restaurants my whole life. I've done everything in between dishwashing to being a general manager, which is prep cook. I've delivered pizzas. I've been a waitress for a long time. I've been a line cook, brand management, menu development. I love the business of food. It's a really special industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, I heard you had worked in the sustainable food industry, which I think also is a case of Osakana. And we'll talk about how sustainable Osakana is later. But where did you work, and what was the motivation to work in sustainability business?
I worked for a sustainable seafood company based in Brooklyn called Sea to Table, which is a really great company that drives a lot of revenue directly to docks. And it was a great place to get a seafood education, especially learning about just the seafood model in America, especially. Mm-hmm. I like sustainable food, though, because at the core of it, it really means sustainable jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think that the future of sustainable food, beyond thinking about where your food came from, which is so important, is also thinking about who serves it to you, who cooks it, and who cultivates
it. It's a whole chain.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are all great jobs that I think have a lot of value.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the Sea to Table, so basically it's... It's kind of like you manage the logistics of everything.
I worked on the logistics side. We used FedEx as a third party to get fish directly from the dock to restaurants, consumers, and even schools.
Mm. So was it kind of, I'm very curious about that because I think, like you said, it's going to be the future. So does the business model work, you think?
I think it's a really challenging business model. FedEx is not a refrigerated truck. And right. when you talk about moving seafood, it's really hard to have a serious conversation without a refrigerated truck, I think, at the end of the day.
Right. So we'll see what happens. Right. And why did you join Osakana?
I joined Osakana because I was looking for a company that really wanted to change something about the food industry, not just about the sourcing, but even just the level of employment and the people that it works with and how it treats people, I think, is really unique.
Mm, right. Okay, so now let's talk about Osakana. So what is the concept of Osakana?
Osakana is a new style of fish store that I think is really focused on variety and respect.
Mm.
I think those are our two main objectives.
Right. And so variety in terms of what kind of fish?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in America, we're driven to eat certain fish because they're popular, they're in market, and the reality is that the best way to eat from the ocean is to eat a huge variety from the ocean.
Mm, okay. But do you normally get all local fish, right, as far as I understand?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but there's a huge variety, I think, of local fish that aren't popular. People just don't think about them because they're not featured as much on menus. When we think about... Oh, nice fish, and you're going to a restaurant, and people automatically go to salmon.
Filet, you know, always.
Yeah. Even going to things like Chilean sea bass that is not local and not particularly amazing or signature as a fish itself. And I feel that there's so many amazing local species that we should be eating, and eating a nice variety of, between like porgy, bluefish, and especially like dogfish, that is a huge... and right now considered bycatch, because if you're line catching fish, you catch so much dogfish, but it deserves a bigger part at our table just because we're catching so much of it, but because it is delicious and a very useful part of our seafood diet.
But I heard dogfish is very hard to process, right? Is it? Or some other fish?
You know, dogfish is also called the boneless fish.
Okay.
So I think arguably it's sometimes easier to process than certain things like fluke that take a lot more attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I'm talking about some other fish, well, because usually...
It was definitely a learning experience, the first one that I broke down, versus something like the bluefish or flatfish, and that have more bones and you know where your knife should go.
Mm-hmm.
But... I once you learn the basic structure of the fish, I don't think it's any more difficult to process. It might be more difficult definitely to make a machine that processes it, because there isn't that rigid guideline for filleting, the same way that running, you can run like perch through a machine and get something that passes for a fillet.
Right.
But I think it's a very good, you get a nice yield off of a dogfish, and I don't find it particularly difficult once you know what you're doing.
Okay. Yeah. But the point is, I think I get an impression you don't mind going through this painstakingly hard processing, and I was always impressed, because I have to confess, I've been to Osaka like more than, I don't know, 15 times since you guys opened in my neighborhood, but it's always amazing that how fresh it is every day. Right. So how do you summarize the difference between Osakana and other fishmongers? It's the local and more variety.
And definitely more attention. And the respect part of it is definitely the attention to detail when we're receiving and cleaning the fish. You can't offer fish for sashimi if you aren't cleaning it thoroughly and cleaning the space that it's prepared in. It's not just about, oh, this fish was healthy or less healthy, or that there's some qualitative assessment of one fish as sashimi grade versus another fish. The fish that come from a healthy ocean are healthy. We can eat those fish as sashimi, but if you don't take care of the fish, if you don't clean it thoroughly before you're butchering it, and if you don't butcher it in a way that controls for any kind of contamination, then that fish, you can't eat sashimi. And some of those other butchering styles are fine for cooking fish. It's more, can be more efficient. You do say when you come and see us, and there's a painstaking process that we go through, that if you were just cooking all the fish, the value added is more for eating fish as sashimi. But even for the dogfish that we're not eating as sashimi, that painstaking process provides very beautiful results and also like very high quality results.
Right. Okay. And do you get fish from Fulton Market or?
Yep. We work directly with Fulton Market.
Okay.
Definitely driving value there. It's a great resource for seafood, especially in New York City. It is the resource for seafood.
And do you focus on East Coast fish or West Coast as well?
We do East Coast primarily. Right now we are running something like salmon, just because it is height of the season. It's a great time to eat salmon. It's a huge, huge abundance of it.
So, I forgot to, one of the favorite things I always have at Osakana is the kama. That's a neck part, which you don't see in other fishmongers often. And it's very, with the bone, that's umami in it. And it's amazing.
It's definitely not as common to eat that in like American food culture, but it was something that we started serving at Okonomi that became so popular that I think a lot of the people that are coming to Osakana from being Okonomi fans were also interested in the collar, the kama. Like, oh, do you have the bluefish kama?
Right.
I want that too. And it's like, of course we do, and we butcher in a way now to make those collars very appealing and presentable and delicious and easy for you to take home.
Right.
They're a great way to cook fish.
Right. Yeah. And I recently went to a Japanese supermarket in, I think it's in Tokyo or some Takayama somewhere, and then they are proudly selling collars because it's such a delicious piece.
Yeah.
And it always comes with the main part. So, yeah, it was a huge shining piece of fish in the Japanese supermarket too.
Yeah.
Right. What kind of fish do you sell to Osakana? You can just name a couple so that listeners can get some ideas.
Today we've got bluefish, for sure, some really nice looking bluefish, tuna belly, got a lot of mackerel's in season right now.
Yeah.
corgi, little... cobia, really beautiful stuff coming out of the water. We've got some really warm water where we live right now, so we're getting a lot of the fish that come from the south.
Right, and maybe you could talk about how it's presented. I think that's another unique thing about Wasakana is... It's almost like going to a jewelry store. So maybe you could describe how it's presented.
We always compare it to the jewelry store, absolutely. I think that's adding the respect and the value to the fish, is we display a small amount of fish. We only have a small amount of fish every day. You know, what we have is what you see. And I think it raises the value of those individual pieces and things like the collar. You know, we only have so many collars. We only bring in so many whole fish. It raises the value of the item.
Right. So basically, once you open a very chic door, wooden door, there is like an Italian, you know, the pastry case. Mm-hmm. It's almost looking like you were picking a jewelry ring or necklace kind of thing. And there's really beautiful Japanese place. And yeah, it's just very fun to visit and see fish. So,
thank you. I mean, it's a... It's a logistical thing, too, that we wanted to make that very obvious step away from just fish on ice, which is a really terrible way to hold fish.
Right.
You know, we've made so much advancements in technology in terms of food storage, refrigeration, and we have much higher standards of cleanliness and contamination than we ever had before, but still people are just throwing out ice and putting fish on it where the fish have not been cleaned. So there's still residue from their life in the water on the outside of the fish. The ice is melting. Those residues are passing from one fish into another fish and even inside the fish, because once it's melted water, it can permeate every part of the fish. And it's more than a little unappealing when you think about it and you see those piles of like fish on ice. And so everything we do with that case is definitely to say, no, you know, we're holding this temperature and moisture controlled, so it's in its peak state for the best time window possible, and we're making sure that everything is very particularly presented, not just to look beautiful but to be high quality product,
right,
to avoid those contaminants and to step above, to kind of move into the future of what fish storage and fish display should be.
So minimum bacteria contamination, right? And who is your customer?
We have a wide customer base. We have a lot of Japanese customers that come all the way from New Jersey and Manhattan. And we have a great local base of customers. Like Luke was saying, everybody that's a guest at Okonomi is already almost one of our customers. Because they understand it. They already subscribe.
Right. Because Okonomi is only, 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
By foot. A short walk.
Right. So after breakfast, let's get some fish.
Take home.
Right. Okay. So, and I'm sure both of you know the Japanese fish culture, learning from Yuji. And how do you compare the difference between, you know, the mindset between Japanese and American consumers about fish?
I mean, it's an interesting comparison. They definitely, in Japan, fish is such a huge percentage of the diet that just is not anywhere in America, not anywhere close. And also that they frequently do eat a variety of fish. There's much more a culture of having a taste of many different things and eating a variety from the ocean instead of just saying like, oh, I just want my salmon entree, you know, but saying I'm going to eat some salmon and some kanpachi, a couple of different things. When you have a sashimi plate, you know, you're having several different types of sashimi. Sometimes it's displayed in a very beautiful way. You get more satisfaction, a sense of fulfillment, because of the variety that isn't just based on consuming a volume, and also because the quality is so high. You get the value there that you feel satisfied when you're eating that way, instead of just trying to eat a volume of protein and needing a certain benchmark.
Right. So, you know, that's a one part, big part. And then I just thought about, you know, what about the fishermen and distributors, right? And in episode 35, Yuji discussed the challenges he often faces in U.S. distribution system. And for instance, American distributors use 50-pound fish container filled with lots of ice. And as a result, fish in the bottom is almost always damaged. And on the other hand, in Japan, each fish is packed in a separate container that fits the size of the fish. So do you have any problems in getting super high-quality fish in, you know, even from Fulton?
I think that there is a demand for high-quality fish already, so we're kind of joining that. But I think driving people to handle individual fish is still, we're still working on it, but we're getting there. Absolutely. You know, not using the hook to move fish, but rather just using your hand.
Things like the Ikejime process, that right now there isn't a lot of pressure from the market to say, like, oh, you know, to tell a fisherman they have to learn this style of working with fish that has to happen on the boat during the catch. And to have them actually make that change in their professional processes, they have to know that there's a market value to it. You know, and so we're helping to educate them, like, oh, you know, if you can take these processes, then we can add value to the fish that you're you're already selling, doing things like that, and how you handle it, how you pack it, is all increasing value for you, increasing value for us, and increasing value for the customer.
And you can charge more for Ikejime. So maybe you can explain listeners what Ikejime is.
Right. Ikejime is a style of when you kill fish, when you catch fish, you're sending a metal rod basically through the spinal column, destroying it, and that interferes with the process of the fish going into rigor, so that it doesn't go into rigor as quickly or as stiffly. And, you know, when a fish is going into rigor, basically it's having a seizure. You know, every muscle in the body is firing and squeezing, and sometimes those forces are happening against each other. It can cause tears in the meat or deterioration even on, like, a smaller level that you might not notice. But that fish then loses moisture more readily after you're filleting too. So it's on many fronts. The Ikejime fish goes into that process more slowly, more gently, comes out of it more gently. It just keeps the meat in a better overall condition.
Right. So like any other animal, the slaughterhouse, if the animal suffers, then the meat taste goes down. It's the same thing, right?
It's the production of lactic acid.
Right. Okay, so Ikejime. The American fishermen should do Ikejime, hopefully. Okay, and so you mentioned the sashimi, you know, and I, you know, sashimi, of course, is really raw fish, and I didn't expect it's possible to have fresh sashimi in this country. So what's the, how do you do that? I mean, this is really fresh, high-quality sashimi. I've tasted so many times. So what's your kind of choice of fish, or
it's definitely the fish we're getting in. We're very fortunate to be working with Nishimaru, who has a lot of experience buying fish for sashimi in Japan from Tsukiji, and now they're sourcing American fish just because they saw American fish of very high sashimi quality. And we're wondering, well, why aren't we sourcing this fish for sashimi if the quality is so great and it's right here? And they have a lot of experience with the market. They go through Fulton Market. They know what they're looking for the best quality fish, and they pass that on to us. But then when we get those fish, it's a lot about the care of cleaning the fish, making sure that it is held in a way that controls for contaminants, controls for moisture, always keeping temperature controlled so that the fish is in a pristine environment as much as possible when we're storing it. And when we are cutting that fish into sashimi portions, that every part of that process is as clean as possible, so that, you know, if you're cutting into a fish when the organs are still in the fish, there's a really high chance of contaminating the meat. And if you don't take the time to clean and to scale and to make sure that the outside of that fish is clean, then you can have scales on your knife while you're cutting, can carry those contaminants along the whole fillet. And then you can't use that fish for sashimi. You know, it's a, sashimi isn't, it is about the fish, and it's also about the kitchen, and the people in the kitchen are, is the kitchen sashimi clean? Are the people working with the fish operating on standards that hold themselves and their workplace to a level of sashimi clean?
Okay. And by the way, Nishimaru, USA, it's I know a couple of people there. They're extremely extremely experienced. And I think they serve distributes fish to Sushi Nakazawa and other amazing top restaurants in the city. Well, I really appreciate you make sashimi. Sosakana.
It's one of the things I think is most special about what we're doing there as like a keystone of it being a Japanese fish market. When I was living in Osaka, as I come from southwestern Pennsylvania, and I grew up eating biscuits and sausage gravy very often. My grandmother would make big Sunday breakfast for my family, and we would have that biscuits and sausage gravy. And in Japan, there was nowhere you could get anything even close to like breakfast sausage that I could find in any of the markets. Sausage is typically a hot dog.
Right.
And you just can't make like sausage sawmill gravy out of hot dogs. And it's so it took me a long time to source those things, and I basically learned how to make the sausage myself so that I could make biscuits and gravy living in Osaka. And so I know what it feels like to have that some part of what should be just a part of your home and just find it so inaccessible in a market. And so to be able to provide Japanese people with something that's like, I can just buy fish, take it home and slice it. And it's such a, it's a very comforting thing. And it's a very simple, easy way to eat healthy on like an everyday basis. And it just means a lot to me to be able to provide that to people. And so I love that we can do that. And there wasn't anywhere in New York that was sourcing fish in a way that, that facilitated that. We had customers coming into Okonomi trying to buy whole fish from us, and Okonomi is a small restaurant. We do what we do there extremely well. We just couldn't expand it within the restaurant to sell whole fish to people. So that's where we knew the demand was there for that in particular, giving people access in New York City to sashimi grade fish to take home and eat sashimi at home.
And I think in New York too, with a small kitchen and limited appliances, sashimi is such an excellent dinner because you know, you bring it home and it's healthy and it's ready.
Right.
And that's it. All you need is a plate.
And the thing is, if you go to a restaurant and they eat sashimi, you have to pay a lot more money. That's for sure. So So sounds like you are going to inspire other restaurants and the fishmonger. I hope.
We especially just making sashimi available to people, even not just Japanese people, but it should be a part of everybody's diet. And it isn't something that should be so... I mean, there are definitely artists like Sushi Nakazawa that are doing something very rarefied and special that is very difficult. It is an art. But in terms of being able to eat sashimi at home with confidence, it's mostly about sourcing. And then from there, it's just a part of... like a normal daily like dinner time routine that isn't something that should feel beyond your grasp. It should be something that, oh, I can do this. This is an easy option for me, and it's a delicious option for me.
Right. I cannot say more than that. It's really amazing. So, all right. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Osakana's fabulous educational classes. So please stay with us.
And this is another song by our former intern, Young Malcolm. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guests today are Luke Duffin and Emma Kramer, the general manager and assistant general manager at Osakana, a new fishmonger in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which opened in August. So now, the Osakana's website calls itself Japanese Fish Market and Educational Center. And you offer educational classes at Osakana. So why is education so important?
I think that taking the mystery out of cooking fish at home and preparing fish at home is a huge goal of ours. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So because you don't know what to do with it, like you see the fish.
Well, I think the things we're doing are different for both Americans and Japanese people living in New York, that the fish we're providing sometimes aren't exactly what Japanese people are used to using for sashimi sometimes. Some of the, like the gray tile, the golden tile fish are similar to Amadai, but maybe not exactly the same in a way that people want to have a conversation. They go, what is this and how does it relate to what I'm used to in Japan? Mm. And Americans might have no real exposure to, or only have exposure to sushi and sashimi in a restaurant context. And so showing those people that this is something you can do at home and taking the mystery out of it, making it feel accessible. It's important that we have that dialogue and that the whole experience is very welcoming.
Mm. Right. And so what kind of classes do you offer? Could you give us some examples?
The most popular class right now is definitely sashimi at home.
Okay.
That's, you know, definitely delicious, very interesting class. Mm. We do ramen, mazamen classes. We've got some shabu-shabu classes, nabe. Okay. We also have a ramen risotto class this month. A huge variety of all different levels.
So the sashimi class, for instance, that's the usually you get the fish, the fish, and then you teach how to cut it. And also the maybe cure it? Or?
Yeah, a lot of the sashimi at home class is about different techniques we apply to fish for curing or creating some different flavors and textures. Things like yakishimo, which is torching the fish, or yubiki, which is using hot water to kind of tighten just the skin layer of fish with a very delicate skin layer that makes a nice textural variance in the fish and lets you eat fish without having to take that skin off and just kind of gives you even more of a breadth of textures and flavors when you're eating fish like that. Yeah, so
it's the one of the misunderstandings about sushi and sashimi is that they actually raw fish, not just cut, but they're really processed.
Yes.
Like carefully with vinegar and salt and, like you said, with some heat as well.
Yeah. Right. There's a huge breadth of techniques that go into preparing sashimi. It isn't just like, oh, it's raw, you know, take the head off and cut it into slices. There's a lot of other processes that go into that. And we do a lot of those things so you can buy fish out of our case that already have those techniques applied to them. Mm. But I think people are really interested in what are those techniques and trying it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. By the way, the classroom is in the back of the beautiful storefront. And I feel one day I'm still hoping there's a beautiful counter, right, the marble. And hopefully you can open a little pop-up restaurant. Eat something.
We are not a restaurant. We are very very happy to not be a restaurant. We like the way that we are working as a market, but we are also really excited to be doing to be able to open that space to our customers for private events. It is a really beautiful space. You can have a really intimate lovely evening there. We've started doing a temaki sushi party, which is nice. So we put up sushi rice and a selection of fish and nori sheets, some other vegetables and other things that you add into your hand-rolled sushi roll. Teach people how you do that. And then people come in groups and they've had a lovely time just enjoying that experience, which is a really interesting Japanese experience too. It's sort of very common in Japan.
Right.
For me, it reminds me of like if you go to a family reunion and they have the tiny rolls and a bunch of cold cuts and you're kind of making your own sandwich. But I think there's even more variety and interesting structures at work.
Right.
You kind of have a very interesting time doing it.
Mm. I like those too because it's not something that you would see or do in a restaurant. Mm. It's really something you would do at home. And I think that once people do it in our store, they're encouraged to do it at home.
Mm. Right. So now summer's ending. You know, let's do a temaki party at home.
Yeah.
Okay. So who takes the classes at Osakana?
Right now, we have a lot of people, mostly, I think, Okonomi customers are the most excited. We're lucky enough to have so many Kickstarter backers that they're also really interested in our classes. But what's nice is that the neighborhood has given us such a great reception that a lot of people from the neighborhood have joined us as well.
Right. So just in case for listeners who don't know, Okonomi is for breakfast and lunch. It's a Japanese-style fish-based breakfast menu with vegetables and miso soup and rice, which is amazing. And at night, it's a ramen place.
So it is, like, thankfully, a lot of people from the neighborhood coming in. Because Okonomi, we fortunate that it's such a signature small place that stands out, that people come from very far away just to eat there. Mm-hmm. And you get people coming out of a cab with a suitcase straight from the airport just to eat in this little 12-seat restaurant for Ichiju Sansai, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Very humbling to have that kind of response from customers. But people can't just come off a plane out of a cab with a suitcase and then come into Osakana and buy fish and take it back to their hotel room. Like, it just doesn't work as well. So the fact that we have so many people in the neighborhood that are coming in three times a week shows that there was a need for this, and that what we're doing, it works, that people enjoy the product. And if we didn't have the neighborhood, if we didn't have people who live there coming in, it wouldn't work. You know, so it's very...
And the best part is seeing people, you know, often post what they cook at home.
Yeah.
And for us, that's the greatest reward, is we get to see really how they're honoring their fish at
right.
home.
And the neighborhood is Williamsburg, so it's kind of a younger, more kind of creative people. But also, I see many Japanese people, older population, American population, at the economy too.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the summary of how American consumers are looking for right now in a healthier diet.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. And so I'm sure some of the listeners will sign up for your classes, but for the rest of us who are too busy or not in New York, maybe you can give us some tips how to cook fish at home.
Sure. People always ask us just how to cook fish. I think something that we do from Okonomi that we're using a lot and recommending a lot to people is just when you're making like yakizakana, like the roasted fish, just a very high heat oven, 450, 500, as high as it'll go. And if you can turn on convection in your oven, that's even better. At Okonomi, we kind of suspend the fish on skewers, but at home, it's fine. Just a cooking sheet, like you might make cookies on, with a sheet of parchment paper, and you put the fish on that, season it with salt, put the fish down skin side up. It's in the oven for like a 4-ounce, 5-ounce piece of fish. It's in the oven 8 or 9 minutes at most. You have really lovely color on the outside, really nice effects out of skin from things like bluefish or tilefish, where the skin actually puffs as you roast it, and the inside is still very moist. It's that temperature differential, so that it's so hot outside, it's cooking the very outside a lot, where the inside doesn't have time to get overcooked. So you get a really beautiful piece of fish that way. And if you think, oh, I don't want to turn my oven up that high, or in the summertime, although now it's the winter, we love running the oven, but it only has to be in the oven 8 to 9 minutes, you know, so it's a very short, quick, easy process.
Right. Okay. Sounds great. And now, everybody knows that fish is good for your health, and the sushi is more popular than ever. So, what do you suggest for American consumers to eat fish sustainably?
I think for us, sustainable really means variety, and it means not getting caught up on one fish or two fish.
Mm.
It means really experiencing all the fish in the area where you live.
Right. And for instance, you carry bluefish often, and I think it's such a perishable fish that you don't see it often, but because your freshness, I really started to like bluefish because it's so tasty.
Absolutely. Or we do a sake katsu marinade on the bluefish, which I think is such a great compliment to that fish. It's like they were always meant to be together.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Which is amazing that they go so well together, but I think it's one of the more signature things in the case for Osakana as a place that is both American and Japanese, because it's American fish that you only get in America, and this Japanese treatment that is very popular in Japan. It really hasn't penetrated American markets yet, but that sake katsu marinade on that bluefish, together, they're just wonderful.
Right. So sake katsu, basically sake leaves.
Yeah.
So the leaves kind of breaks down the protein in the fish and make it more kind of tender.
Yeah.
And the umami is increased.
And for such a high oil fish that, you know, very perishable, also sake katsu is a real preservative.
Right. And full of omega-3 fatty acid and just good everything. Right.
For sustainability also, we also really focus on what in other butcher shops you might call like off cuts, but so using things like the belly of yellowfin tuna or swordfish, selling other parts of the fish like the collar that aren't always used in other restaurants or in other markets, and saying, you know, like, these are also part of the fish we're catching, and it's not enough to say that we're, where does my tuna come from, or is my tuna sustainable? It's you know, if you are eating that tuna as a whole animal, the way that we've started to eat pigs and cows, then then that is more sustainable for no matter what you're catching, to eat all of it, you know, because all of it is delicious. It takes some knowledge, but that tuna belly from the yellowfin is amazing also. Oh, yeah. It's a really rich, very meaty piece of fish that is so versatile in so many ways, from grilling to roasting to braising. It's really amazing. And the swordfish is it's a very rich product. You don't need a whole lot of it at one time, but it is also a very signature, amazing fish experience. It's so rich. It's almost like bacon made from swordfish that you can't get that kind of flavor and texture out of fish otherwise. And this is something that's just not being utilized at all in the market, that it's very important that we use fish in a whole way.
Right. And also I think seasonality too, right? Because it's in season, fattier, tastier, and you capture that moment too. Yeah.
The mackerel that, you know, we were getting recently, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. Yeah. Very beautiful.
Wow. Okay. So the Tozakana's sister restaurant, Okonomi, nearby. Mm-hmm. So do you have any benefit of having restaurant to, you know, like maybe you can create a synergy? I mean, not to waste ingredients, that kind of thing. Because, you know, you cut like head off. Mm-hmm. And then probably you don't sell it to Osakana, right? But then you might be able to use it to Okonomi for stock or something like that.
Well, so we actually make a ramen stock ourselves.
Oh, okay.
At Osakana. So the heads and the bones of everything we butcher ends up going into our own ramen broth, which is all fish, which is very, very rare for ramen. And it's hard, I think, making a fish broth that is balanced in the way that the Yuji ramen broth is amazingly balanced, but we're using bones, pork and chicken bones from the Meat Hook, which is really great that they partner with us like that. It makes an amazing product, but there we're only adding one or two types of fish maybe per batch of broth, and here we have, you know, can have a dozen different fish contributing to one batch of broth,
right.
And it makes a very balanced, beautiful flavor experience and something that's all fish.
I don't think I've ever tasted an old fish. Dashi, yeah, I have to get that one.
it's one of my favorite things that we do there, and a really great product. Yeah, you should try.
Okay, and this is my last question. So what is your plan for the future at Osakana?
Oh, wow. We have big plans. We're changing the world through fish. That's our number one plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I think besides that, we're creating a community where we're based in between Okonomi and Osakana, which is really encouraging people to cook differently at home and embrace Japanese cooking, which is a simple, really accessible way to cook, I think, in New York, especially with all the amazing markets that we have around us.
And there's a rumor that that community is expanding to Japan, too.
Yes.
Right? Absolutely.
So
very, very exciting to have Yuji Ramen will be in the Ramen Museum in Shin Yokohama starting next year. And we also have a nice partnership with which is a restaurant in Tokyo. And so it's very exciting that we're going to start having exchange between our staff. It'll really help promote a lot of our understanding, because we hire a lot of people from Brooklyn. And it's not necessarily a lot of Japanese people making Japanese food, but we're using Brooklyn ingredients and we're using a lot of Brooklyn staff and educating them about Japanese food. But it's lovely to give those people the opportunity to go to Japan to learn directly from Japanese kitchens and to receive Japanese cooks, to have them learn what we're doing here, to expose them to American fish and to learn from them as well the things that they maybe take for granted about being trained to work in a kitchen in Japan that are very unique to us.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
Once it starts, you guys have to come back.
Yeah. Yes. Love
okay. It. Well, so Luke and Emma, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
So listeners, if you would like to know more about Osakana, please visit osakanabk.com. That is osakanabk.com, osakana.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And yes, now we have our own email address for Japaneats. So if you have any requests for guests or topics, you can just send an email to us too. And Japaneats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and the Stitcher podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Corin and our engineers David Tatasciore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.